Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Have you ever wondered what James Madison might think about the Supreme Court of Chief Justice Roberts? Or, to put a finer point on it, what Mr. Madison might say about Roe v. Wade or Citizens United? How might Thomas Jefferson respond to Martin Luther King Jr.'s assertion in 1963 that King had come to collect on a promissory note from Mr. Jefferson? To flip our historical premise, how many of us in 21st century America realize that John Adams, way back in the late 1700s, predicted our current state of gaping economic inequality? And to go back to the ultimate founding father, George Washington, how many of us recognize that the isolationist cries of the 2016 campaign echo Washington's era? These scenarios and many more intriguing what-ifs populate a fascinating new book by historian Joseph Ellis. It's called American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. It is Mr. Ellis's ninth book exploring the Revolutionary Era and the men who cobbled together the world's first democratic, small d, superpower. He joins us today to discuss the founders and how what happened in 1776 and 1787, among other years, figure into our current political debate. Joseph Ellis, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Eric, it's a real pleasure to be with you.
Well, this book tackles four main subjects. You look at race, you look at economic equality, you look at law and foreign policy, seen from the founder's perspective, and, of course, ours today. That's a little bit of a change for you because typically you've stayed back in the 18th century or somewhere in that realm, and you use Jefferson, Adams, Madison, and Washington as your focal points for these topics. I want to ask you, how did you come upon this particular concept and this particular structure for a book?
Well, you're right. I'm doing something here that I haven't done before, and that historians, and I am a professional card-carrying historian, are not supposed to do. That is, we're supposed to be detached. We can't be objective. That's for mathematicians and physicists, perhaps, but we are supposed to not self-consciously bring the values of the present back with us to the past. I think that's a worthy goal, detachment, but it's an impossible goal because in the end, all of us are living in the present, in the now, and we can't. And I'm going to try to make a virtue of that liability by self-consciously bringing back to the 18th century the problems and predicaments and troubles that currently afflict us. I started writing this book in 2014, or started researching it then, before the words Donald and Trump were abroad in the land. And though obviously in the course of working on it, Trump's candidacy and presidency happened. And he's not a major figure in the book. This is not a comment on his presidency, but it is a comment on the conditions that made Trump possible. And those, as you suggest, I think that race is a problem. I think we're in some sense, Trump is an airburst in the night that exposes who we really are. And on the race front, I think it exposes the fact that and North Carolina is a place where this would be an interesting thing to discuss. A significant portion of the American populace, it's a minority, but not a small minority, has never fully accepted the full implications of the civil rights movement. And when Barack Obama was elected president, thoughts that we had now entered a kind of post-racial society were naive in the extreme. And the closer we get to 2045, when the white population will become a statistical minority, I think the more intense the opportunity for demagogues will be. And I think that now it's possible for the first time in maybe 50 years to play the race card up instead of playing the race card down. So some of those were the thoughts that I carried with me as I went back there into the 18th century.
And as you just mentioned, you started this project before Donald Trump was on the political scene, or at least in his you know, his most prominent iteration, let's put it that way. But at the same time, we have recent histories by John Meacham and Doris Kearns Goodwin that also sort of play out this conversation between what's happening now and crises of the past, political dissension of the past. And they very much were, and if they've discussed this, they very much were inspired by the Trump presidency. So when we see this movement in terms of historians, what do you make of that? What is the hunger, the interest among Americans to look backward in a perhaps more focused way right now?
Both John Meacham and Doris Kearns Goodwin, both of whom I know well. In fact, I'm going to be on a panel with them in a week or two in something like Columbus, Ohio. They go back to the Civil War, in the case of both of them, really, and bring forward their study of the liberal tradition and Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson. And essentially what they're saying is that the cavalry will be coming to the rescue sometime in the near future. That the history shows that there's a oscillation back and forth between liberal and conservative values, and that we're in a backlash moment, and that we should look forward to that ending soon. I'm putting words in their mouth, but I think I'm being fair-minded. I go all the way back to the late 18th century, and my intention is to not predict what's going to happen. Historians are no better prophets than anybody else. We're great we're prophets of the past. We're omniscient. We can tell you what, you know, we can predict the past with unbelievable clarity, and we'll tell you that most prophets are wrong. And in some sense, I'm saying that the founders went back to the classics in Greek and Roman history, to Thucydides and to Tacitus and to Cicero and Plutarch. And I'm going back to our classics, Adams, Washington, not Jefferson this time. He appears, of course. Jefferson does, of course. And see if they can help us frame the questions that face us now better. What we all have in common as historians is we're conscious of living in an extremely troubled time, when America's destiny no longer looks so manifest, when we're deeply divided into our bubbles, into our apps, into our different media platforms. And in some sense, I'm arguing that argument is itself the answer. The dialogue means the ability to discuss and to argue strenuously about our different priorities. And that's what the founders, that's one of the things that made the founders great. There's a built-in checks and balances within the founding generation, not just in the Constitution itself. Temperaments and ideologies that differ interact, and the argument itself, in some sense, is the answer.
Again, we're speaking with Joseph Ellis. He is the author of American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. So let's dig into this book a little bit. The section that you devote to equality and economics includes the long-running arguments and conversation between Adams and Jefferson in that famous series of letters from 1812 to 1826. One thing that really struck me was the discussion of American exceptionalism. You quote Adams writing, "There is no special providence for Americans," end quote. How did that view and Adams' perspective on fame and property foretell our modern world, you think?
Yeah, it's an interesting dialogue. The Washington would agree with the conclusion, too, and that most people who talk about American exceptionalism now are talking about a belief that, and it's religious form, is, you know, God takes care of women, children, and the United States of America. but that we are the poster child for the liberal tradition in the world, and that that is inevitably going to dominate the whole globe, and that we've created a model for the liberal state in the revolutionary era that will take seeds everywhere, Middle East and Africa, etc. Adams and Jefferson get into an argument about this because Jefferson believes that that's going to happen. These values are eternal. And Adams says, no, that the conditions under which the United States comes into existence were distinctive and exceptional. And that for that very reason, we shouldn't expect these values to be able to take root in countries with very different histories. He mentions Latin America as one place because it's Catholic and hierarchical. But he also says, and the big one for them at that time is France because of the French Revolution. We shouldn't expect the French Revolution to follow the same course as the American. But they, what Adams is saying here has an impact on foreign policy that, as well as economic policy. He's really saying that the proper posture for us is to be a city on a hill, yes, to perfect as much as we can our own kind of liberal society, but that we shouldn't expect it. I mean, for example, we shouldn't expect the seeds of Jeffersonian democracy to take root in the Middle East. The belief that Iraq was going to become a democracy was always a delusion. And therefore, long occupations of foreign countries are not a good idea, and the American people won't put up with them for very long. So that American exceptionalism means because we are unique in our origins, we're not necessarily the poster child for all the countries in the world.
One of the things that you do in this book really well, I think, is that you go back to the language itself that these founding fathers were using, and you sift through what they meant, how it changed over time, how they argued about it. And I'm going to ask you about the most basic phrase that all of us know from the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, Thomas Jefferson wrote. And it's all men are created equal. And it meant one thing. Hello. Hello, puppy. It meant one thing to Jefferson. It meant another thing to Abraham Lincoln. And it means still other things to us today. How did that shift over time?
It did. And oh, boy, I mean, that's a biggie. Those are the magic words of American history that you're quoting, and they are the foundation for the liberal tradition in America. I think that that on the race front, Jefferson meant that that slavery was wrong, and Lincoln is the one who insists that that's the right interpretation. In some sense, remember Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, famously said that he really didn't intend. He was just an umpire calling balls and strikes, and you know, to which I would say, well, there was no baseball in 1787, but that the whole point is the strike zone keeps expanding. What we mean by those words has expanded enormously. It now includes people without people who can vote without property. It includes women. It includes blacks. It now includes gays. And so it is the expansion of the meaning of those terms. And what does the term we the people mean? In 1787, we the people meant about 800,000 people who could actually vote. Women couldn't vote. Indians couldn't vote. Blacks couldn't vote. People without property couldn't vote. And so the Constitution is an inherently living document. It keeps changing. It keeps expanding, but within the context of the original.
Let me interrupt you, Professor Ellis. We're going to pick up that thought in just a minute. We're going to take a quick break, then we're going to be back with Professor Ellis talking about American dialogue. You're listening to Charlotte Talks here on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we are speaking with Joseph Ellis. He is a historian of the Revolutionary Era, and his new book is called American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. And Professor Ellis, forgive me, I had to interrupt you there for the break, but you were discussing all men are created equal and how that has shifted over time, if you don't mind picking up your story.
OK. Okay. Before I did that, I took my dogs outside so they wouldn't be disturbing your listeners. Thank you. Two lovely labradoodles. You would all love them.
Well, they're very interested in the conversation, so we appreciate that.
They've heard it all before. I think that I guess I'm arguing here that these words, all men are created equal, they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. These rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are the magic words of American history. Jefferson wrote them. The meaning they had then has expanded. Nope, at the time of the Continental Congress when he wrote that, it's interesting that they spent a day revising Jefferson's draft of the Declaration, and they made many changes. They made they changed about 30% of the text, deleted things, revised things. They never touched that first paragraph. Jefferson had originally written, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." In the committee, the five-man committee that wrote that created this document, gave the task to Jefferson. Franklin was a member, and he's the one who probably, we're not sure, suggested the change, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." Let's not bring God into the equation. Later in the Constitution, when people said, "How come God is not mentioned in the Constitution?" Hamilton said, "It never came up." And this becomes the American creed over time. It's Lincoln who does the big transformation and calling attention to that. It's Lincoln who says the real document that we need to go back for our original intentions and values isn't the Constitution, it's the Declaration. And it's that argument that allows him to claim that slavery itself is incompatible with the values of the Revolution, which most people at the time, including Jefferson and most of the slave owners, agreed with. But the words themselves have magic power. But, for example, Jefferson himself never believed that they included blacks. Jefferson did not believe that blacks and whites could live together in the same society. And so that when King says that he's coming to collect on a promissory note written by Jefferson at the this is in 1963 in the I Have a Dream speech. He's standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, not the Jefferson Memorial. And that's historically correct because Jefferson himself didn't really believe that we should be a biracial society. And so I like to think that if you're visiting Washington, you want to stand somewhere on the Mall and look at Jefferson, Lincoln, and Martin Luther King and ask them to have a conversation. and that would be one of the most interesting conversations in American history.
Well, I also like your idea that there should be a memorial to John Adams, and it would be near Jefferson's so that they could cast shadows on one another.
Thank you for that. I love that. I mean, I'm proud of that phrase. I testified before Congress once with David McCulloch arguing for a memorial on the Mall to Adams. We agreed that it should be Adams, Abigail, and John Quincy, so we'd get the family values people committed to it, too. And that's when I suggested it be on the tidal basin in such a location that, contingent on the time of the day and the angle of the sun, if they take turns casting shadows across each other's facades. Nothing has happened. Can you believe this? But nothing.
Well, they've been so busy accomplishing everything else that we wanted them to do.
I'm sure that's true.
I'm going to bounce around here because there's so much in the book I want to try and hit. In your section about Madison and the law, you delve into originalism, both with the Constitution and all aspects of our founding fathers and what they did. And it's so interesting the way you go through how Madison's thinking evolved both from an idealistic way and also pragmatically as he's trying to get this approved by people who are, of course, arguing over it. when you look at the Second Amendment, as you do closely, and the Heller case that Justice Scalia championed, you make some pretty powerful arguments about why.
Yeah, I'm going to offend a lot of people with that. This is,
yes.
I mean, I have offended a lot of people with that.
I was going to ask you. So, you make a clear case that you are, pardon the pun, that you don't see any merit in the argument that Scalia made, and you pretty much dispose of originalism as a concept, as something that's almost not only untenable, but impossible to carry out. So, what has been the response from your readers who may be more conservative or Republican-leaning?
There's some people who think I'm right and some people who think I'm wrong, but among the lawyers, I think that the dominant view that, and the jurists, is that originalism is a judicial doctrine that some people like and some people don't like. It's the view of all of the Republican nominees, or now Republican justices on the Supreme Court. It's the view of the Federalist Society, which was created in the early 1980s as a place for conservative jurists who believe, as Scalia, it was the main, he saw himself as the main spokesman for that point of view, that their function was to go back to the original meaning of the words in the Constitution. The first person arguing this was a guy called Bork, Robert Bork. Mm-hmm. He talked about original intentions. That wasn't going to work very well, because if you go back and look at what the people back there said and their intentions, one of their intentions was not to be canonized. They wanted to be remembered, but they didn't believe the words they spoke at the time or the meaning of them should hold true for the next 200 years. They thought that it was a living constitution. Every generation, in Jefferson's view, need to reinterpret it in its own way. I do the Madison chapter before then to show the reader that this is how the Constitution really got created. Madison's the central player, and you watch him shift his positions in accord with the political forces he's dealing with. The Constitution, in the end, as Madison understands it, is an inherently living document, and they've created a language which is deliberately ambiguous, so that, especially on the issue of federal versus state sovereignty, and so that there's no original meaning back there to recover. In terms of the Second Amendment, if you actually read what Madison wrote, and he's the one who wrote the entire, what we call the Bill of Rights. By the way, nobody called it the Bill of Rights back then. They just called it the first 10 amendments.
It was FDR, right?
FDR is the person who coined, who made the phrase Bill of Rights popular in the 1930s, and especially becomes popular as we get into World War II, because these are the values we're fighting for against Hitler. But that, basically, Madison took the recommendations from the different states that the ratified, the recommendations that they had. When they ratified, they said, we have these reservations and we like these recommended amendments. He took them. There were 200 of them. There were a lot of duplications. So there were about 100. And one of them was their fear of a standing army. They were fearful of, you know, based on their experience with the British Army, but even the Continental Army as a kind of potentially malevolent and tyrannical force. And they wanted to be sure that the defense of the country, of the United States, was in the hands of state militia, because those people were under control in a way that the federal army would not be. At any rate, that's what the people who passed it in the Senate and the House in 1789, and then the states that ratified it, thought they were doing. And I do a dissection of the Heller decision, and suggest that it's a kind of trip through a labyrinth in Alice in Wonderland. But I pick it because, again, Scalia says, this is my masterpiece. There is something going on there that's kind of what they call law office history. As a lawyer, you're given your client, and you're to defend or prosecute the person. and that your job is to shape all the evidence that supports your client's case and to suppress as much of it as you legally can what doesn't. And that, therefore, that kind of partisan approach, which is a kind of a debater's approach, you're given the position, is a conventional way of thinking within the legal profession. And so Scalia feels it's perfectly okay to cherry-pick the evidence in order to try to come up with the conclusion that he, a lifetime member of the National Rifle Association, believes is correct. And but that's not historical. That's not, historians don't do that. They're not supposed to do that anyway. And historians are always on the one hand, on the other hand, a lot of paradox, a lot of irony. So that I really do that the real meaning of the Second Amendment is enshrined in law in the Militia Act of 1791. As soon as the Second Amendment is ratified, they pass a law incorporating what they think its meaning is. And its meaning is that every adult male between the ages of 18 and 49, or no, 45, must purchase a musket and what they call an outfit and be ready to serve. The real meaning of the Second Amendment is mandatory national service. The term bear arms doesn't mean own a gun. It means carry a weapon in a military unit.
And you point out that Justice Scalia lopped off or ignored the first part of the statement, or the amendment, I should say, which was about the militia. The main point, right, as you say, was to avoid having a federal army and to maintain state control over defense. That was what right. It was about. And
that's what the NRA does too. In this, there's a big plaque in the NRA headquarters in Washington in which they lop off the first part, and they quote Patrick Henry. There's a phrase that they claim Henry spoke. You know, they're coming to take away your guns. He never said that. And what he did say is they're coming to take away, and then the N word. There's been a concerted, orchestrated effort by the NRA since the late 60s, early 70s to get the principle of your unlimited right to bear arms as endorsed in the law. And in some sense, the NRA wages a campaign for that succeeds in Heller in the same way that the NAACP waged a campaign starting in the 1940s, bearing fruit in 1954 in the Brown decision for desegregation, one on the right and one on the left, but that these are really decisions that harvest public opinion that has shifted over that time. And that's really what Scalia is doing. And it's, God rest his soul. I have nothing against Mr. Scalia personally. I did meet him a couple times. But I want to have a debate with people about this. And this is difficult. But in the debate, you know, if somebody gets up in the audience and says to me, you know, I believe that, and he opens up his coat and he's got his gun inside there, he's carrying, he says, I believe I have a unlimited right to do this. And I would say, well, first of all, we got to understand there's no such thing as an unlimited right. Even your right to free speech doesn't include the right to shout fire in a crowded theater, of course. And but that, can we agree on the following and then begin to argue? You have a right to own a gun. I have a right not to get shot. Can we begin there? Most of the time, they won't do that because they believe that any infringement on their right to carry a weapon is going to be a slippery slope down which then they lose everything. And I don't think that's true. That's the way I would frame it now in what I think would be a fair-minded discussion about the role of guns. The rest of the world, in case anybody doesn't know it, thinks we are out of our minds. I mean, we have almost as many guns in the United States as we have people, and every week we have a massacre now. And this is the rest of the world thinks that this is just crazy. ISIS, or excuse me, not ISIS, Al-Qaeda sends out emails to its people saying, it's going to really be great for you to kill as many Americans as you want to because you can get automatic weapons really easily there. And so there are implications to this, and I think some kind of restriction on automatic weapons and military-gauge weapons and greater background checks is obviously something we should do, and what stands in the way is this D.C. versus Heller decision.
You, more broadly speaking, you describe the long-running belief among Americans that the Constitution is sacred, that the Founding Fathers, every word is sacred, not to be trifled with. You describe those as childish fables that have probably fallen by the wayside.
Right.
In the same breath, can you say that because that fable has come unraveled, that perhaps more of the population will be willing to view this as a living document that needs to keep up with its contemporary times?
Well, if I'm successful, yes, and if people think about it, I think that's true. I mean, the founders did, as I said earlier, did not want to be canonized, Most nations, new nations, invent mythical heroes. It's an important way to galvanize opinion over time behind the national experiment. So Rome has Romulus and Remus. England has King Arthur. Those people are fictional characters. The American founders are real people. The bulk of my work over the last 30 years or so has been to try to show that they are very much human beings. They are extraordinarily gifted and, like us, imperfect. Indeed, if they really were gods, if tongues of fire actually appeared over their heads in 1787 at the convention, what in heaven's name would we have to learn from them? They are imperfect creatures, and the language that they, most of the founders who commented on it, for example, they would think, they would be aghast that we still have the Electoral College.
We will be back with more with Joseph Ellis. We're talking about his new book, American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is Joseph Ellis. He is the author of American Dialogue, The Founders and Us, and he is a Revolutionary Era historian. There's so much I want to ask you about. I haven't even asked you one question about George Washington, so let me do that right now. In the section on Washington and foreign policy, this sentence hit me like a hammer. Quote, "The last time the United States went to war as the Constitution stipulated was December 8th, 1941. You also write that war in modern America is, quote, not declared, few have to fight, and no one has to pay, end quote. So how did we reach this point, and can it be fixed?
Well, we reached this point largely in the 1940s, as the United States became a superpower, and then as nuclear weapons became a reality. And that virtually required the executive branch to have an unprecedented level of control over decisions about going to war, especially if you only had 8 minutes to decide whether to launch or not launch. And executive power increases in any government once you're a superpower and once the foreign policy becomes such an important part of your agenda. And the Washington believed that war was what he called the dernier resort, the last resort. You don't do it until you've really looked at the question as carefully as possible, assured yourself you're prepared to pay the price. People are going to have to go. You're going to have higher taxes. And the impact on the overall economy is going to be an increase in the debt. Are you prepared to take all that? And we don't do that anymore. We defer the decision to the commander in chief. In some sense, it's a function of congressional cowardice. And we get into wars in strange ways. I mean, like, and this is something we should all be mindful of. You know, like, the battleship Maine wasn't blown up by insurgents. It was an internal explosion. The Lusitania was carrying weapons across to England. Now, there really was an attack on Pearl Harbor, but the second attack on the American destroyer in the Gulf of Tonkin was a pod of whales. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Iraq had no connection to Al-Qaeda, so that the incidents that create, that become the triggers that get us into wars are often concocted. And I think that especially since the end, since the draft was ended by Richard Nixon in 1973 or four, two generations or three have grown up in America without any presumption that they have to serve. And I don't think we would have gotten into Iraq and Afghanistan if the, there was a draft. So for those reasons, we're in an unusual situation now. We're a superpower that is engaged in what is really a series of perpetual wars. And I think that some it is, as is case with many of the things that the book attempts to address, I think we know what the answers here are, and I think we know that given the Congress of the United States and the political culture of the United States at this moment, none of them are possible. That it's going to be very, I mean, if I was, I am an advocate for mandatory national service. I think that's a very, very important idea. It has absolutely no chance right now. In this case, I think that Washington's tradition also as an isolationist policy is something that he would say is no longer relevant. It's no longer possible. And we are a superpower, and the world is connected in a way that makes isolation impossible. And that the question is not whether we're a superpower, but what kind of superpower we are. I think we have to decide what we're not going to do as well as what we are going to do. Right now, we're spread out over the world in terms of American garrisons, and we are implicit in a kind of global version of mission creep. We think that we're responsible for the whole world. That's an impossible mission. And we never did have the conversation at the end of the Cold War in 1991 or two about what we should do now that the evil empire is gone. And we've built up all this military-industrial complex to fight the Russians of the Soviet Union, and we've never discussed what we should be doing now. We now have – we spend more money on defense than the next 10 nations combined. So I'm going on too long here, Eric, but those are my thoughts.
I want to read a listener question. This comes to us from Twitter. And the listener says, if you could resurrect the founding fathers and they could write one new constitutional amendment unfettered, what do you think it would be?
That's a good question. And I love the question. Let's remember that the founders are all busy being dead.
Very good point. Excellent point.
We don't have time machines. And so what you're asking me is based on my reading of all their papers. And I've read most of the papers of the founders. What does Joe Ellis think? And that's really what's going on here. And I'm just channeling myself through Madison and Jefferson and those guys. And I think that the thought that occurs to me is that the Electoral College was anachronism almost from the beginning, and a gerrymandered kind of Rube Goldberg contraption. The rest of the world doesn't understand it. And for good reason. I think that popular election of the presidency was something that they seriously considered in the debates in the summer of 87, and they didn't think it was logistically possible then. It is obviously possible now. So that to the listener, the one thing I think that they would expect us to do is to get rid of the Electoral College. Madison, in 1829, in his old age, was asked about how long he thought the Constitution would last. And he said it would be really, really lucky if it lasted 100 years. most of them would be surprised that we still have the document that they wrote, obviously with all the amendments added, and that in some sense they would want us to have a second constitutional convention. They'd redo the whole thing. And especially, let's say, why does North and South Dakota have four senators, twice as many as California, when the population of North and South Dakota is less than half of Los Angeles? That's an interesting problem we should think about, too. But the problem here is, once again, Eric, if you say, let's have a second constitutional convention, it would be a circus.
Oh, I was just trying to imagine. That would be a lot of fun with Twitter and Instagram.
I mean, and again, this is paradoxical. The reason the constitutional convention worked was it was closed. It was 55 white guys gathered together, a property gathered together in secrecy. We could never do it that way again. I mean, we need transparency, we need involvement, and of course, we're now 330 million people. We're not 4 million as they were then. And but I do think that there's some really essential changes that would be necessary for the adjustment to occur. And the first item for your listener is, let's get rid of the Electoral College.
That was the voice of John Adams, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, and George Washington, as channeled through Joseph Ellis, who's the author of American Dialogue. Well done. So I want to ask you about, there is a moment in the book, you write about a French duke who was visiting Jefferson at Monticello. The Frenchman observes that Jefferson opposes slavery, but at the same time sets so many conditions on emancipation as to render it impossible. And you follow that up with this line. You write, at the time of the good Duke's visit, Sally Hemings was nursing Jefferson's second child.
Right. I mean, the bulk of the scholarship since 97, when there was a DNA study of Jefferson's heirs, is to conclude there's disagreement on this. There's no such thing as settled law in history as there is in law. But the consensus is that Jefferson was the father of Sally Hemings' children, and she had four children that lived to maturity, a total of six, and that that the irony of that and the hypocrisy of that is that the main reason Jefferson offered for not stepping forward to assume a leadership position to end slavery, when he was a president especially, is that he could not, in good conscience, end slavery until there was a plan in place to remove all the blacks from the United States, all the African-American people. And not initially thought maybe we'd put them out in the West. And of course, after the Louisiana Purchase, that was possible. But he said, no, that's going to be reserved for Native Americans. And so he meant back to Africa, Liberia, or maybe the Dominican, Santo Domingo, they called it there, in the Caribbean. And the reason was that he believed that blacks and whites, if they live in the same society, will interact and eventually intermarry and eventually create a mongrel race. And that race will be an inferior race, inferior to the Anglo-Saxon white race, a corruption. And that's that's wrong. You can't do that. Now, at the very moment that he's making these statements, he's creating at Monticello almost a laboratory in racial amalgamation. Now, not only is he himself fathering children by Sally, but there's a lot of that going on among all the Hemings women, who are all physically attractive according to white standards, and that the slaves that you see at Monticello, the ones that work in the house, are almost all members of the Hemings family. There's about 40 of them. And when you go to Monticello, when you look at slavery, it looks like it's almost, these people are almost white. Sally was three quarters white. Her children were 7/8 white. Jefferson believed that blacks could become members of the society and amalgamated only when they became white. Namely, he said 7/8. He said the first crossing is they're still black. The second crossing, they're still black. The third crossing, when they become 7/8 white, he said the blood clears. And that's an awful phrase, but that's what he said. And that, so that the underlying problem for Jefferson isn't slavery. He really does think that should end. But the underlying problem is what happens afterwards, and he thinks, and by the way, this is dominant view in even among abolitionists in the early 19th century. Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin has an appendix in the first edition saying, and once slavery ends, this is where we're going to send him. So that we're living at a moment. Our belief in a biracial society is a modern idea. It's a mid-20th century idea. Very few of the founders could imagine a biracial society. They could imagine a large-scale republic. They could imagine the separation of church and state. They could imagine multiple sources of political sovereignty, all of which were visionary. They could not imagine a biracial society.
Now, I'm going to switch from a very heavy, serious topic to probably the most important question I can ask you, which is the Hamilton touring production was recently in Charlotte, and I'm wondering, do you and your fellow historians, do you just send the book galley straight to Lin-Manuel Miranda now, just in case?
I'm good friends with Ron Chernow, who wrote the book Hamilton, on which this was based. Miranda really is a genius, and I should have included Hamilton in my book because that would have made it much more popular. if you talk to your kids now, or in my case, my grandkids, they can quote to you from every part of that play, and it's almost Harry Potter all over again. But I think the founders would be surprised that I'm surprised. If you told me that there's a founder who is going to become a national figure in a big, big way, in the biggest Broadway play or success musical of modern era, I would have never believed it was going to be Hamilton. And it's Miranda who did this, and I think the immigrant issue is part of the success. But it's really that Miranda's a genius, and that the hip-hop music allows the play to deliver 2 to 3 times as much information as anything else. I remember saying to Chernow, gee, Ron, I don't know. Hip-hop music, I don't know about that. He said, Joe, think Elizabethan sonnets. And I've seen the play 2 times, and it's the most energetic and most compelling thing, and you have to see it a couple times before you can follow everything. Hamilton, I'm on record as believing Hamilton was probably the smartest of the founders, the sheer brain power. He would have got the highest grades on the LSATs. But he's also dangerous. If you give full power to Hamilton, we tend towards autocracy. If you give full power to Jefferson, we tend towards anarchy. It's the balance there. It's the interaction there that makes something that's the kind of hybrid that we have possible. And nevertheless, I've always I'm jealous as hell of Chernow.
So for your next book, when you come on, we're going to have you rap. So prepare yourself for that. We appreciate you spending some time with us. Joseph Ellis, author of American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. Do you already have your next idea before we let you go? Do you already have your next idea?
Yeah, a book called Lest We Forget, Lost Stories from the Revolution.
Oh, there we go. So we can look forward to that. Again, that's Joe Ellis. He's the author of American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. It's out right now. Fascinating look at the Founding Fathers and the political differences we have today. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Thanks so much for listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.